on itself when she lived with Bertha Shanklin never came now. My weekly visits were the high spots of her life. She was always waiting for me on Saturday afternoon with her hat on. I knew what the hat meant. She hoped that this time I would take her away. This was the hope of many of the patients, and when the presiding physician made his appearance, there were scenes in which women clutched at his sleeves, and even, I could not have believed it if I had not seen it, fell on their knees and tried to kiss his hands, for all those who had some freedom of movement knew that the power to dismiss them lay with him. A few of the younger ones tried to make a sexual association of it, and their cries were, "Oh, Doc, you know I'm your girl, Doc. You're going to let me go this time, aren't you, Doc? You know you like me best." I couldn't have stood it, but he did. The sexual fetor in the place was hateful to me. Of course, I was known as Mary's fella, and they assured her that every visit was sure to bring deliverance. I took her chocolates, because they were something she could give the others, most of whom did not have regular visitors. Let me say again that I was not bitter against the hospital. It was a big place in a big city, obliged to take all who were brought to it. But an hour among these friendless, distracted people was all I could bear. Many of them became known to me, and I got into the custom of telling them stories. As the stories of the saints were the bulk of my store, I told many of those, avoiding anything too miraculous or disquieting, and especially, after one bad experience, anything about wonderful deliverances from prison or bondage of any sort. They liked to be talked to, and when I was talking to a group, I was at least not struggling to make conversation with Mrs. Dempster alone, and seeing the unvoiced expectancy in her eyes. Those visits rubbed deep into me the knowledge that though reason may be injured, feelings live intensely in the insane. I know my visits gave her pleasure, in spite of the weekly disappointment about not being taken elsewhere. After all, I was her special visitor, looked on by the others as an amusing fellow with a fund of tales to tell, and I gave her a certain status. I'm ashamed to say how much it cost me in resolution. Some Saturdays I had to flog myself to the hospital, cursing what seemed to be a life sentence. I should have been objective. I should have regarded it as my good work. But my association with Mrs. Dempster made that impossible. It was as though I were visiting a part of my own soul that was condemned to live in hell. Are you wondering, why didn't he go to Boy Staunton and ask for money to put Mrs. Dempster in a better place, on the grounds that she was a Deptford woman in need, if not because of Staunton's part in making her what she was? There is no simple reply. Staunton did not like to be reminded of Deptford except as a joke. Also, Boy had a way of dominating anything with which he was associated. If I got help from him, which was not certain, for he always insisted that one of the first requirements for success was the ability to say no, he would have established himself as Mrs. Dempster's patron and savior, and I would have been demoted to his agent. My own motives were not clear or pure. I was determined that if I could not take care of Mrs. Dempster, nobody else should do it. She was mine. Do you ask? If he couldn't afford to put the woman in a private hospital or get her into a private patient section of a government hospital, how did he pay for those jaunts abroad every summer? He seems not to have stinted himself there. True. But in my servitude to Mrs. Dempster, I was not wholly lost to my own needs and concerns. I was absorbed in my enthusiasm for the world of the saints and ambitious to distinguish myself in explaining them to other people. And I had to have some rest, some refreshment of the spirit. My diary tells me that I visited Mrs. Dempster 40 Saturdays every year, and at Easter, Christmas, and on her birthday in addition. If that does not seem much to you, try it, and judge then. She was always downcast when I announced that I was off on my summer travels, but I hardened myself and promised her plenty of postcards, for she liked the pictures, and the receipt of mail gave her status among the patients. Did I do all that I could? It seemed so to me, and certainly it was not my intention to join my saint in the madhouse, as Blazon had threatened, by making myself a mere appendage to her sickness. My life was absorbing as well. I was now a senior master in the school, and a very busy man. I had completed my first book, 100 Saints for Travelers, and it was selling nicely in 5 languages, though mostly in English, for Europeans do not travel as Britishers and Americans do. It was written simply and objectively, telling readers how to identify the most common saints they saw in pictures and statuary, and why these saints were popular. I avoided the Catholic gush and the Protestant smirk. I was collecting material for my next book, a much bigger piece of work, to be called The Saints, A Study in History and Popular Mythology, in which I wanted to explore, first of all, why people needed saints, and then how much their need had to do with the saintly attainments of a wide range of extraordinary and gifted people. This was biting off a very large chunk indeed, and I was not sure I could chew it, but I meant to try. I was keeping up my association with the Bollandists, too, and writing for Analecta and also for the Royal Historical Society whenever I had anything to say. I had become even more caught up in the life of the Stauntons. Boy liked to have me around, much as he liked to have valuable pictures and handsome rugs. I gave the right tone to the place. By that I mean that it put him in a position of advantage with his friends to have someone often in his house who was from a different world, and when he introduced me as a writer, I could hear the capital letter. Of course, he had other writers, and painters, musicians, and actors as well, but I was the fixture in the collection, and the least troublesome. If this sounds like a sneering requital for the hundredweights of excellent food and the pailfuls of good drink I consumed under his roof, let me say that I paid my way. I was the man who could be called at the last minute to come to dinner when somebody else failed, and I was the man who would talk to the dullest woman in the room, and I was the man who disseminated an air of culture at the most Philistine assemblage of sugar boilers and wholesale bakers without making the other guests feel cheap. Having me in the dining room was almost the equivalent of having a Rayburn on the walls. I was classy, I was heavily varnished, and I offended nobody. Why did I accept a place that I now describe in such terms? Because I was tirelessly curious to see how Boy was getting on, to begin with. Because I really liked him, in spite of his affectations and pomposities. Because if I did not go there, where else would I meet such a variety of people? Because I was always grateful to Boy for his financial advice, which was carrying me nicely through the Depression, and which would in time make it possible for me to do better for Mrs. Dempster and to arrange a broader life for myself. My motives, like those of most people, were mingled. If his social life interested me, his private life fascinated me. I have never known anyone in whose life sex played such a dominating part. He didn't think so. He once told me that he thought this fellow Freud must be a madman, bringing everything down to sex the way he did. I attempted no defense of Freud. By this time, I was myself much concerned with that old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners, C.G. Jung. But I had read a great deal of Freud, and remembered his injunction against arguing in favor of psychoanalysis with those who clearly hated it. Sex was so much of the very grain of Boy's life that he noticed it no more than the air he breathed. Little David must be manly in all things. I remember a noisy row he had with Leola when she allowed the child to have a Highlander doll. Did she want to make his son a sissy? The doll was put in the garbage pail before the weeping eyes of David, who liked to take it to bed. He was 6 at the time. And then he was rewarded with a fine, practical steam engine, which drove a circular saw that would really cut a matchstick in two. At 8, he was given boxing gloves and had to try to punch his father on the nose as Boy knelt before him. With little Caroline, Boy was humorously gallant. "How's my little sweetheart tonight?" he would say as he kissed her small hand. When she had been brought in by the nurse to be shown off to a room full of guests, Boy always followed them into the hall to tell Caroline that she had been by far the prettiest girl in the room. Not surprisingly, David was a confused lad, pitifully anxious to please, and Caroline was spoiled rotten. Leola was never told that she was the prettiest woman in the room. Boy's usual attitude toward her was one of chivalrous patience with a discernible undertone of exasperation. She loved him abjectly, but she was the one person on whom he spent none of his sexual force, except in the negative form of bullying. I tried to stand up for Leola as much as I could, but as she was utterly unable to stand up for herself, I had to be careful. If I was angry with Boy, as sometimes happened, she took his side. She lived her life solely in relation to him. If he thought poorly of her, it did not matter what I might say to defend her. He must be right. Of course, it was not always as black and white as this. I remember very well when first she discovered that he was having affairs with other women. She did so by the classic mishap of finding a revealing note in his pocket. The Stauntons rarely escaped cliché in any of the essential matters of life. I knew of his philandering, of course, for Boy could not keep anything to himself, and used to justify his conduct to me late at night when we had both had plenty of his whiskey. A man with my physical needs can't be tied down to one woman, especially not a woman who doesn't see sex as a partnership, who doesn't give anything, who just lies there like a damned sandbag, he would say, making agonized faces so that I would know how tortured he was. He was explicit about his sexual needs. He had to have intercourse often, and it had to be all sorts of things, intense, passionate, cruel, witty, challenging, and he had to have it with a real woman. It all sounded very exhausting and strangely like a sharp workout with a punching bag. I was glad I was not so demandingly endowed. So there were two or three women in Montreal, not whores, mind you, but women of sophistication and spirit, who demanded their independence even though they were married, whom he visited as often as he could. He had business associations in Montreal, and it was easy. The mention of business reminds me of another phase of Boy's sexuality, of which he was certainly unconscious, but which I saw at work on several occasions. It was what I thought of as corporation homosexuality. He was always on the lookout for promising young men who could be advanced in his service. They must be keen apostles of sugar, or donuts, or pop, or whatever it might be, but they must also be clean-cut. Whenever he discovered one of these, Boy would take him up, ask him to luncheon at his club, to dinner at his home, and to private chats in his office. He would explain the mystique of business to the young man, and push him ahead as fast as possible in the corporation, sometimes to the chagrin of older men, who were not clean-cut, but merely capable and efficient. After a few months of such an association, disillusion would come. The clean-cut young man, being ambitious and no more given to gratitude than ambitious people usually are, would assume that all of this was no more than his due, and would cease to be as eagerly receptive and admiring as he had been at the beginning of the affair, and might even display a mind of his own. Boy was dismayed to find that these protégés thought him lucky to have such gifted associates as themselves. Some went so far as to marry on the strength of their newfound hopes, and Boy always asked them to bring their brides to dinner at his house. Afterward, he would demand of me why a clean-cut young fellow, with everything in his favor, would wreck his chances by marrying a girl who was obviously a dumb cluck and would simply hold him back from real success in the corporation. One way or another, Boy was disappointed in most of these clean-cut young men. Of those who survived this peril, he wearied in the natural course of things, and they became well-placed but not influential in his empire. I do not suggest that Boy ever recognized these young men as anything but business associates, but they were business associates with an overtone of Jove's cup-bearer that I, at least, could not ignore. Corporation Ganymedes, they did not know their role, and thus were disappointments. Leola's awakening came at the fated Christmas of 1936. It had been an emotionally exhausting year for Boy. The old king, George V, had died in January, and in memory of that glance that had once passed between us, I wore a black tie for a week. But Boy was in high feather, for he would at last mount the throne. They had not met for 9 years, but Boy was as faithful to his hero as ever. He reported every bit of gossip that came his way. There would be great changes, a throne more meaningful than ever before, a wholesale ousting of stupid old men, a glorious upsurge of youth around the new king, and, of course, a gayer court. The gayest, probably, since that of Charles II. And a gay court to Boy meant an exaltation of the punching-bag attitude to sex. If he had ever read any of those psychologists who assert that a crowned and anointed king is the symbolic phallus of his people, Boy would have agreed wholeheartedly. As everyone knows, it was not long before the news took a contrary turn. On the North American continent, we got it sooner than the people of England, for our papers did not have to be so tactful. The young king, he was 42, but to people like Boy he seemed very young, was having trouble with the old men, and the old men with him. Stanley Baldwin, who had been with him on that visit to Canada in 1927, and whom Boy had revered as a statesman with a strong literary bent, became a personal enemy of Boy's, and he spoke of the Archbishop of Canterbury in terms that even Woodywiss, now an archdeacon, found it hard to overlook. When the crisis came, there was some extravagant talk of forming a group of king's men who would, in an unspecified way, rally to the side of their hero and put his chosen lady beside him on the throne. Boy was determined to be a king's man. Everybody who considered himself a gentleman, and a man who understood the demanding nature of love, must necessarily feel as he did. He lectured me about it every time we met. As a historian, I was very sorry for the king, but could see no clear or good way out of the mess. I believe Boy even sent a few telegrams of encouragement, but I never heard of any answers. When the black month of November came, I began to fear for his reason. He read everything, heard every radio report, and snatched at every scrap of gossip. I was not with him when he heard the sad broadcast of abdication on 11 December. But I looked in at his house that evening and found him, for the only time in his life, to my knowledge, very drunk and alternating between tears and dreadful tirades against all the repressive forces that worked against true love and the expression of a man's real self. Christmas was a dark day at the Stauntons. Leola had had to buy all the presents for the children, and Boy found fault with most of them. The fat janitor from the Alpha offices appeared in a hired suit to play Santa Claus, and Boy told him in front of the children not to make a jackass of himself, but to get on with his job and get out. He would not open his own gifts from Leola and the children. By the time I had made my visit to Mrs. Dempster at the hospital and turned up for midday Christmas dinner, Leola was in tears. David was huddled up in a corner with a book he was not reading, and Caroline was rampaging through the house, demanding attention for a doll she had broken. I joked with David, mended the doll so that it was crippled but in one piece, and tried to be decent to Leola. Boy told me that if I had to behave like one of the bloody saints I was always yapping about, he wished I would do it somewhere else. I unwisely told him to take his abdication like a man, and he became silently hateful and soured the food in our stomachs. He announced that he was going for a walk, and he was going alone. Leola, grieved for him, went to fetch his overcoat and happened on the note from one of the great-spirited women in Montreal while looking for his gloves in a pocket. She was crouching on the stairs, sobbing dreadfully, when he went out into the hall, and he took in the meaning of her desolation at a glance. "There's no reason to carry on like that," he said, picking up the fallen coat and putting it on. "Your situation is perfectly secure. But if you think I intend to be tied down to this sort of thing," and he gestured towards the drawing room, which was, I must say, a dismal, toy-littered waste of wealthy, frumpish domesticity, "you can think again." And off he went, leaving Leola howling. I wish I did not have to say howling, but Leola was not beautiful in her grief. The nurse was off duty for the day, but I managed to shoo the children upstairs to their own quarters and spent a hard hour quieting her. I wish I could say I comforted her, but only one man could have done that, and he was trudging through the snow, deep in some egotistical hell of his own. At last I persuaded her to sleep, or at least to lie down, and wait to see what would happen. Nothing was ever quite so bad as it looked, I assured her. I did not really believe it, but I intended to have a word with Boy. She went to her room, and when I thought a sufficient time had passed, I went up to see how things were getting on. She had washed her face and tidied her hair, and was in bed in one of the expensive nightdresses Boy liked. "Will you be all right if I go now?"
"Kiss me, Dunny." "No, not like that. That's just a peck. You used to like to kiss me."
Whether she knew it or not, this was an invitation that might lead to much more. Was the story of Gyges and Candales to have the ending in which Gyges takes his friend's wife? No. Upon the whole, I thought not. But I leaned over and kissed her a little less formally.
"That's no good. Kiss me really."
So I did. and if my artificial leg had not given an ominous croak as I knelt on the bed, I might have gone on, doubtless to cuckold Boy Staunton, which he certainly deserved. But I recovered myself and stood up and said, "You must sleep now. I'll look in later tonight, and we'll talk with Boy."
"You don't love me," she wailed.
I hurried out the door as she burst into tears again. Of course I didn't love her. Why would I? It had been at least 10 years since I had thought of her with anything but pity. I had made my bed, and I intended to lie on it, and there was no room for Leola in it. On my last few visits abroad, I had spent a weekend with Diana and her husband at their delightful country house near Canterbury, and had enjoyed myself greatly. I had survived my boyish love for Diana, and I certainly had survived anything I ever felt for Leola. I was not to be a victim of her self-pity. The emotional upheaval caused by her disappointment about Boy's unfaithfulness had sharpened her sexual appetite, that was all. I do not suppose Boy had slept with her since the beginning of the trouble that led to the abdication. I was not going to be the victim of somebody else's faulty chronology. I went for a walk myself, at another Christmas dinner, it was impossible to avoid heavy food on that day, and arrived back at the school at about 9 o'clock, intending to do some reading. Instead, I was greeted by a message from the furnace man, who was the only person left on duty that day. I was to call the Staunton's number at once. It was an emergency. I called, and the children's nurse spoke. She had come back from her holiday, found the housemaid and the cook and butler still out, and had looked in on Mrs. Staunton to say goodnight. Had found her in a very bad way. Did not like to explain over the phone. Yes, had called the doctor, but it was Christmas night, and an hour had gone by, and he still had not come. Would I come at once? Yes, it was very serious. The nurse was becoming a little hysterical, and I hurried to obey. But on Christmas night it is not simple to get taxis, and altogether it was half an hour before I ran upstairs to Leola's bedroom and found her in bed, white as the sheets, with her wrists bound up in gauze and the nurse near to fits. "Look at this," she said, gasping, and pushed me towards the bathroom. The bath seemed to be full of blood. Apparently Leola had cut her wrists and laid herself down to die in the high Roman fashion in a warm bath. But she was not a good anatomist and had made a gory but not a fatal job of it. The doctor came not long after, rather drunk but fairly capable. The nurse had done all that was immediately necessary, so he redressed the wrists, gave Leola an injection of something, and said he would call again on Boxing Day. "I sent for you at once because of this," said the nurse as soon as the doctor had gone. She handed me a letter with my name on the envelope. It read, "Dearest Dunny, this is the end. Boy does not love me, and you don't either, so it is best for me to go. Think of me sometimes. I always loved you. Love, Leola." Fool, fool, fool. Thinking only of herself and putting me in an intolerable position with such a note. If she had died, how would it have sounded at an inquest? As it was, I am sure the nurse read it, for it was not sealed. I was furious with Leola, poor idiot. No note for Boy. No, just a note for me, which would have made me look like a monster if she had not made a mess of this, as of so much else. However, as she began to pull around, I could not reproach her, though I was very careful not to mention the note. Nor did she. It was never spoken of between us. Boy could not be found. His business address in Montreal knew nothing of him, and he did not return until after New Year's Day, by which time Leola was on the mend, though feeble. What passed between them I do not know, and was never told, but from that time onward they seemed to rub along without open disagreement, though Leola faded rapidly and looked more than her years. Indeed, the pretty face that had once ensnared both Boy and me became pudgy and empty. Leola had joined the great company of the walking wounded in the battle of life. The people who seemed to suffer most from this incident were the children. The nurse, controlled and efficient in emergency, had broken down in the nursery and hinted broadly that Mummy had almost died. This, taken with the quarrel earlier in the day, was enough to put them on edge for a long time. David was increasingly quiet and mousy, but Caroline became a screamer and thrower of tantrums. David told me many years later that he hated Christmas more than any other day in the calendar. Chapter 5 Liesel 1 Let me pass as quickly as possible over the years of the Second World War, or World War II, T-O-O, as the name my pupils give it always sounds in my ears. It is as if they were asserting firmly that the World War I remember so vividly was not the only or the biggest outburst of mass lunacy in our century. But I cannot leave it out altogether, if only because of the increase in stature it brought to Boy Staunton. His growth as an industrialist with, figuratively speaking, his finger in hundreds of millions of pies, not to speak of other popular goodies, made him a man of might in the national economy, and when the war demanded that the ablest men in the country be pressed into the national service, who but he was the obvious candidate for the post of Minister of Food in a coalition cabinet? He was very good in the job. He knew how to get things done, and he certainly knew what the great mass of people liked to eat. He put the full resources of his Alpha Corporation and all the subsidiary companies it controlled to the job of feeding Canada, feeding its armed services, and feeding Britain so far as the submarine war would permit. He was tireless in promoting research that would produce new concentrates, chiefly from fruits, that would keep fighting men and the children in a bombed country going when bulkier eatables were not to be had. If the average height of the people of the British Isles is rather greater today than it was in 1939, much of the credit must go to Boy Staunton. He was one of the few men, not a professional scientist, who really knew what a vitamin was and where it could be found and put to work cheaply. Of course, he had to spend most of his time in Ottawa. He saw little of Leola or his children during the war years, except on flying visits during which lost intimacies could not be recaptured, not even with his adored Caroline. I saw him from time to time because he was by now a member of our board of governors, and also because David was a boarder in the school. David could have lived at home, but Boy wanted him to have the experience of a community life and of being disciplined by men. So the boy spent the years from his 10th to his 18th birthday at Colburn, and when he got into the upper school at about 12, he came under my eye almost every day. Indeed, it was my duty in 1942 to tell this unhappy boy that his mother had died. Poor Leola had become more and more listless since the outbreak of war. As Boy grew in importance and his remarkable abilities became increasingly manifest, she faded. She was not one of those politicians' wives who lets it be known that her husband's competence is kept up to the mark by the support and understanding she gives him. Nor was she of the other strain who tell the newspapers and the women's clubs that though their husbands may be men of mark to the world, they are sorry wretches at home. Leola had no public life and wanted none. She had completely given up any pretense at golf or bridge or any of the other pastimes in which she had attained to mediocrity in her younger days. She no longer read fashionable books or anything at all. Whenever I went to see her, she was knitting things for the Red Cross, vast inner stockings for sea boots and the like, which she seemed to do automatically while her mind was elsewhere. I asked her to dinner a few times, and it was heavy work, though not so heavy as having dinner at the Staunton's house. With Boy away and both the children in school, that richly furnished barrack became more and more lifeless, and the servants were demoralized, looking after one undemanding woman who was afraid of them. When Leola fell ill of pneumonia, I informed Boy and did all the obvious things and did not worry. But that was before the drugs for dealing with pneumonia were as effective as they now are, and after the worst of it was over, a considerable period of convalescence was needed. As it was difficult to travel to any warmer climate, and as there was nobody to go with Leola, she had to spend it at home. Although I cannot vouch for this, I have always thought it suspicious that Leola opened her windows one afternoon when the nurse had closed them, and took a chill, and was dead in less than a week. Boy was in England, arranging something or other connected with his ministry, and duty and the difficulty of transatlantic flights in wartime kept him there. He asked me by cable to do what had to be done, so I arranged the funeral, which was easy, and told the people who had to be told, which was not. Caroline made a loud fuss, and I left her with some capable schoolmistress who bore the weight of that. But David astonished me.
"Poor Mum," he said. "I guess she's better off, really."
Now what was I to make of that from a boy of 14? And what was I to do with him? I could not send him home, and I had no home of my own except my study and bedroom in the school. So I put him there, and made sure one of the matrons looked in every hour or so to see that he was not utterly desolate, and had anything it was in the school's power to give him. Fortunately, he slept a lot, and at night I sent him to the infirmary, where he could have a room of his own. I kept him by me at the funeral, for both the older Stauntons were now dead, and the Crookshanks were so desolated themselves that they could only hold hands and weep. Association with the Crookshanks had not been encouraged by Boy, so David was not really well known to them. It was one of those wretched late-autumn funerals, and though it did not actually rain, everything was wet and miserable. There were not a great many present, for all the Staunton's friends were important people, and it seemed that all the important people were so busy fighting the war in one way or another that they could not come. But there were mountains of costly flowers, looking particularly foolish under a November sky. One unexpected figure was at the graveside. Older, fatter, and unwontedly quiet though he was, I knew Milo Papel in an instant. As Woodywis read the committal, I found myself thinking that his own father had died at least 12 years before, and I had written to Milo at that time. But the Kaiser, whom Myron Papel had impersonated so uproariously at the hanging in effigy after the Great War, had lived, presumably untroubled by the hatred of Deptford and places like it, until 1941. Had lived at Dorn, sawing wood and wondering what world madness had dethroned him, for 23 years after his fall. I pondered on the longevity of dethroned monarchs when I should have been taking farewell of Leola. But I well knew that I had taken leave of her, so far as any real feeling went, that Christmas afternoon when she had appealed to me for comfort and I had run away. Everything since had been a matter of duty. Milo and I shook hands as we left the cemetery.
"Poor Leola," he said in a choked voice. "It's the end of a great romance. You know, we always thought her and Perse was the handsomest pair that ever got married in Deptford. And I know why you never got married. It must be tough on you to see her go, Dunny."
My shame was that it was not tough at all. What was tough was to go with David back to that awful empty house and talk to him until the servants gave us a poor dinner, then take him back to school and tell him I thought it better that he should go to his own room, as he must sometime resume his ordinary life, and the sooner the better. Boy was always fussing that David would not be a real man. He seemed a very real man to me through all this bad time. I could not have seen as much of him as I did if I had not been temporary headmaster. When the war began, our head had rushed off to throw himself upon the foe from the midst of the Army's education program. He stepped in front of a truck one night in the blackout, and the school mourned him as a hero. When he left, the governors had to get a headmaster in a hurry, but the war made good men so scarce that they appointed me, pro tem, without any increase in salary, as we must all shoulder our burdens without thought of self. It was taxing, thankless work, and I hated all the administrative side of it. But I bent to the task and did what I could until 1947, when I had a difficult conversation with Boy, who was now a CBE, for his war work, and the chairman of our board of governors. "Dunny, you've done a superb job during the whole of the war and long beyond. But it was fun, wasn't it?" "No, not fun. Damned hard slogging. Endless trouble getting and keeping staff. Managing with our old men and some young ones who weren't fit for service, or teaching, if it comes to that. Problems with war guest boys who were homesick, or hated Canada, or thought they could slack because they weren't in England. Problems with the inevitable hysteria of the school when the news was bad, and the worse hysteria when it was good. The fag of keeping up nearly all my own teaching and doing the administration as well. Not fun, Boy." "None of us had an easy war, Dunny. And I must say you look well on it. The question is, what are we to do now?" "You're the chairman of the board. You tell me." "You don't want to go on being head, do you?" That depends on the conditions. It might be much pleasanter now. I've been able to get a pretty good staff during the last 18 months, and I suppose money will be more plentiful now the board can think about it again.
But you've just said you hated being head.
In wartime, who wouldn't? But as I say, things are improving. I might get to like it very much. Look, old man, let's not make a long business of this. The board appreciates everything you've done. They want to give you a testimonial dinner. They want to tell you in front of the whole school how greatly indebted they are to you. But they want a younger headmaster. How young? You know my age. I'm not quite 50, like yourself. How young does a headmaster have to be nowadays?
It isn't entirely that. You're making this awfully tough for me. You're unmarried. A headmaster needs a wife.
When I needed a wife, I found that you needed her even more. That's hitting below the belt. Anyhow, Leo wouldn't have... Never mind. You have no wife. Perhaps I could find one in a hurry. Miss Gostling at our sister school, Bishop Cairncross's, has been giving me the glad eye in an academic way for 2 or 3 years. Be serious. It's not just the wife, Dunny. We have to face it. You're queer. The sin of Sodom, you mean? If you knew boys as I do, you would not suggest anything so grotesque. If Oscar Wilde had pleaded insanity, he would have walked out of court a free man.
No, 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 I don't mean kid simple. I mean queer, strange, funny, not like other people.
Ah, that's very interesting.
How am I queer?
Do you remember poor old ironmonger who had a silver plate in his head and used to climb the water pipes in his room and address his class from the ceiling? Now, he was queer. Or that unfortunate alcoholic, Bateson, who used to throw a wet boxing glove at inattentive boys and then retrieve it on a string. I always thought they added something to the school, gave boys a knowledge of the great world that state schools dare not imitate. Surely you do not think I am queer in any comparable way.
You are a fine teacher. Everybody knows it.
You are a great scholarship getter, which is quite another thing. You have a reputation as an author, but there it is.
There is what? It's this saint business of yours. Of course, your books are splendid. But if you were a father, would you want to send your son to a school headed by a man who was an authority on saints? Even more, would you do it if you were a mother? Women hate anything that's uncanny about a man if they think of entrusting a son to him. Religion in the school is one thing. There is a well-understood place for religion in education. But not this misty world of wonder workers and holy wizards and juiceless women. Saints aren't in the picture at all. Now, I'm an old friend, but I'm also chairman of the board, and I tell you it won't do.
Are you kicking me out?
Certainly not. Don't be extreme.
You surely understand that you are a tremendous addition to the school as a master. Well-known writer on a difficult subject, translated into foreign languages, amusingly eccentric and all that. You would be a disaster as a peacetime headmaster.
Eccentric? Me?
Yes, you. Good God, don't you think the way you rootle in your ear with your little finger delights the boys? And the way you waggle your eyebrows, great wild things like mustaches. I don't know why you don't trim them, and those terrible Harris tweed suits you wear and never have pressed. And that disgusting trick of blowing your nose and looking into your handkerchief as if you expected to prophesy something from the mess. You look 10 years older than your age. The day of comic eccentrics as heads has gone. Parents nowadays want somebody more like themselves. A headmaster created in their own image, eh? Well, you obviously have somebody virtually hired, or you wouldn't be in such a rush to get rid of me. Who is it?
Boy named you, headmaster.
I had never heard of you then, so there can be no malice in reporting this conversation. We haggled a little more, and I made Boy squirm a bit, for I felt I had been shabbily used. But at last I said, "Very well, I'll stay on as chief of history and assistant head. I don't want your testimonial dinner, but I should like you, as chairman, to address the school and make it very clear that I have not been demoted as soon as you could get somebody their parents like better. It will be a lie, but I want my face saved. Say the demands of my writing made me suggest this decision, and I pledge my full support to the new man. And I want 6 months' leave of absence on full pay before I return to work." Agreed. You're a good sport, Dunny. Where will you go for your 6 months? I have long wanted to visit the great shrines of Latin America. I shall begin in Mexico with the shrine of the Virgin of Guadalupe. There you go, you see? You go right on with the one thing that really stood between you and a headmaster's job. Certainly. You don't expect me to pay attention to the opinion of numbskulls like you and your board, and the parents of a few hundred cretinous boys, do you? 2. So there I was, a few months later, sitting in a corner of the huge 19th-century Byzantine Basilica at Guadalupe, watching the seemingly endless crowd of men and women, old and young, as it shuffled forward on its knees to get as near as possible to the miraculous picture of the Virgin. The picture was a surprise to me. Whether it was because I had some ignorant preconception about the tawdriness of everything Mexican, or the extravagantly Latin nature of the legend, I had expected something artistically offensive. I was by now, in a modest way, a connoisseur in holy pictures, ranging from catacombs and the blackened and glaring holy face at Lucca to the softest Raphaels and Murillos. But here was a picture reputedly from no mortal hand, not even that of St. Luke, that had appeared miraculously on the inside of a peasant's cloak. In 1531, the Virgin had appeared several times on this spot to Juan Diego and bidden him to tell Bishop Zumárraga that a shrine in her honor should be built there. When Zumárraga very naturally asked for some further evidence of Juan Diego's authority, the Virgin filled the peasant's cloak with roses, though it was December, and when he opened his cloak before the bishop, not only were the roses there, but also, on the inner side of it, this painting, before which the bishop fell on his knees in wonderment. As unobtrusively as possible, for I try hard not to be objectionable when visiting shrines, I examined the picture through a powerful little pocket telescope. Certainly, it was painted on cloth of a very coarse weave, with a seam up the middle of it that deviated from the straight just enough to avoid the Virgin's face. The picture was in the mode of the Immaculate Conception. The Virgin, a peasant girl of about 15, stood on a crescent moon. The painting was skilled, and the face beautiful, if you dismiss from your mind the whorish mask that modern cosmetics have substituted for beauty, and think of the human face. Why was the right eye almost closed, as though swollen? Very odd in a holy picture. But the colors were fine, and the gold, though lavish, was not barbarically splashed on. Spain might be proud of such a picture, and the proportions, the width would go about 3.5 times into the length, were those of a tilma such as I had seen peasants wearing outside the city. A very remarkable picture indeed. The picture was not my chief concern, however. My eyes were on the kneeling petitioners, whose faces had the beauty virtually every face reveals in the presence of the Goddess of Mercy, the Holy Mother, the figure of divine compassion. Very different these from the squinting, lip-biting, calculating faces of the art lovers one sees looking at Madonnas in galleries. These petitioners had no conception of art. To them, a picture was a symbol of something else, and very readily the symbol became the reality. They were untouched by modern education, but their government was striving with might and main to procure this inestimable benefit for them. Anti-clericalism and American bustle would soon free them from belief in miracles and holy likenesses. But where, I ask myself, will mercy and divine compassion come from then? Or are such things necessary to people who are well-fed and know the wonders that lie concealed in an atom? I don't regret economic and educational advance. I just wonder how much we shall have to pay for it, and in what coin. Day after day, I sat in the basilica for a few hours and wondered. The sacristans and nuns who gave out little prints of the miraculous picture grew accustomed to me. They thought I must be a member of that tiny and eccentric group, the Devout Rich, or perhaps I was writing an article for a tourist magazine. I put something in every outthrust box and was left alone. But I am neither rich nor conventionally devout, and what I was writing, slowly, painstakingly, and with so many revisions that the final version was not even in sight, was a sort of prologue to a discussion of the nature of faith. Why do people all over the world and at all times want marvels that defy all verifiable facts? And are the marvels brought into being by their desire? Or is their desire an assurance rising from some deep knowledge, not to be directly experienced and questioned, that the marvelous is indeed an aspect of the real? Philosophers have tackled this question, of course, and answered it in ways highly satisfactory to themselves. But I never knew a philosopher's answer to make much difference to anyone not in the trade. I was trying to get at the subject without wearing either the pink spectacles of faith or the green spectacles of science. All I had managed by the time I found myself sitting in the Basilica of Guadalupe was a certainty that faith was a psychological reality, and that where it was not invited to fasten itself on things unseen, it invaded and raised bloody hell with things seen. Or, in other words, the irrational will have its say, perhaps because irrational is the wrong word for it. Such speculation cannot fill the whole of one's day. I used to rise early and go to the shrine in the morning. After luncheon, I followed the local custom and slept. I explored the city until dinner. After dinner, what? I could not sit in the public rooms in my hotel, for they were uncomfortable after the Spanish fashion. The writing room was dominated by a large painting of the Last Supper, a more than usually gloomy depiction of that gloomiest of parties. Apparently nobody had been able to touch a bite, and a whole lamb, looking uncomfortably alive, though flayed, lay on a platter in the middle of the table with its eyes fixed reproachfully on Judas. I tried the theater and found myself sitting through a drama that I identified as Sardou's Frou-Frou, heavily Hispanicized and given a further Mexican flavor. It was slow going. I went to one or two films, American pieces with Spanish soundtracks. With relief, I discovered from a morning paper that a magician might be seen at the Teatro Chueca, and I booked a seat through my hotel. Enthusiasm for magic had never wholly died in me, and I had seen the best illusionists of my time. Thurston, Golden, Blackstone, the remarkable German who called himself Kalanag, and Harry Houdini not long before his death. But the name of the man who was to perform in Mexico was unknown to me. The advertisement announced that Magnus Isengrim would astonish Mexico City after having triumphantly toured South America. I assumed that he was a German who thought it impolitic to appear in the States at present. Very soon after the curtain rose, I knew that this was a magic entertainment unlike any I had ever seen. In the 20th century, stage magicians have always been great jokers. Even Houdini grinned like a film star through most of his show. They kept up a run of patter designed to assure the audience that they were not to be taken seriously as wonder workers. They were entertainers and mighty clever fellows, but their magic was all in fun. Even when they included a little hypnotism, as Blackstone did so deftly, nobody was given any cause for alarm. Not so Magnus Isengrim. He did not wear ordinary evening clothes, but a beautiful dress coat with a velvet collar and silk knee breeches. He began his show by appearing in the middle of the stage out of nowhere. He plucked a wand from the air and, wrapping himself in a black cloak, suddenly became transparent. Members of his company, girls dressed in fanciful costumes, seemed to walk through him. Then, after another flourish of the cloak, he was present in the flesh again, and four of the girls were sufficiently ghostly for him to pass his wand through them. I began to enjoy myself. This was the old Pepper's Ghost illusion, familiar enough in principle, but newly worked up into an excellent mystery. And nobody on the stage cracked a smile. Isengrim now introduced himself to us. He spoke in elegant Spanish, and it was clear at once that he did not present himself as a funny man, but as one who offered an entertainment of mystery and beauty, with perhaps a hint of terror as well. Certainly his appearance and surroundings were not those of the usual stage magician. He was not tall, but his bearing was so impressive that his smallness was unimportant. He had beautiful eyes and an expression of dignity, but the most impressive thing about him was his voice. It was much bigger than one would expect from a small man, and of unusual range and beauty of tone. He received us as honored guests and promised us an evening of such visions and illusions as had nourished the imagination of mankind for 2,000 years, and a few trifles for amusement as well. This was a novelty. A poetic magician who took himself seriously. It was certainly not the role in which I had expected to re-encounter Paul Dempster. But this was Paul, without a doubt. So self-assured, so polished, so utterly unlike the circus conjurer with the mustache and beard and shabby clothes whom I had met in La Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite more than 15 years before, that it was some time before I could be sure it was he. How had he come by this new self, and where had he acquired this tasteful, beautiful entertainment? It was so elegantly presented that I doubt if anyone in the Teatro Chueca but myself realized how old it was in essence. Paul did not do a single new trick. They were all classics from the past, well known to people who were interested in the history of this curious minor art and craft. He invited members of the audience to have a drink with him before he began his serious work, and poured red and white wine, brandy, tequila, whiskey, milk, and water from a single bottle. A very old trick, but the air of graceful hospitality with which he did it was enough to make it new. He borrowed a dozen handkerchiefs, mine among them, and burned them in a glass vessel. Then, from the ashes, he produced 11 handkerchiefs, washed and ironed. When the 12th donor showed some uneasiness, Isengrim directed him to look towards the ceiling, from which his handkerchief fluttered down into his hands. He borrowed a lady's handbag, and from it produced a package that swelled and grew until he revealed a girl under the covering. He caused this girl to rise in the air, float out over the orchestra pit, return to the table, and, when covered, to dwindle once again to a package, which, when returned to the lady's purse, proved to be a box of bonbons. All old tricks, all beautifully done, and all offered without any of the facetiousness that usually makes magic shows so restless and tawdry. The second part of his entertainment began with hypnotism. From perhaps 50 people who volunteered to be subjects, he chose 20 and seated them in a half-circle on the stage. Then, one by one, he induced them to do the things all hypnotists rely on: rowboat, eat invisible meals, behave as guests at a party, listen to music, and all the rest of it. But he had one idea that was new to me. He told a serious-looking man of middle age that he had just been awarded the Nobel Prize and asked him to make a speech of acceptance. The man did so with such dignity and eloquence that the audience applauded vigorously. I have seen displays of hypnotism in which people were made to look foolish, to show the dominance of the hypnotist. There was nothing of that here, and all of the 20 left the stage with dignity unimpaired, and indeed with a heightened sense of importance. Then Isengrim showed us some escapes from ropes and straps bound on him by men from the audience who fancied themselves as artists in bondage. He was tied up and put into a trunk, which was pulled on a rope up into the ceiling of the theater. After 30 seconds, Isengrim walked down the center aisle to the stage, brought the trunk to ground, and revealed that it contained an absurd effigy of himself. His culminating escape was a variation of one Houdini originated and made famous. Isengrim, wearing only a pair of bathing trunks, was handcuffed and pushed upside down into a metal container like a milk can, and the top of the milk can was fastened shut with padlocks, some of which members of the audience had brought with them. The milk can was lowered into a tank of water, with glass windows in it so that the audience could see the interior clearly. Curtains were drawn around the tank and its contents, and the audience sat in silence to await events. Two men were asked to time the escape, and if more than 3 minutes elapsed, they were to order the theater fireman who was in attendance to break open the milk can without delay. The 3 minutes passed. The fireman was given the word and made a very clumsy business of getting the can out of the tank and opening the padlocks. But when he had done so, the milk can was empty, and the fireman was Isengrim. It was the nearest thing to comedy the evening provided. The third and last part of the entertainment was serious almost to the point of solemnity, but it had an erotic savor that was unlike anything I had ever seen in a magic show, where children make up a considerable part of the audience. The Dream of Midas was a prolonged illusion in which Isengrim, assisted by a pretty girl, produced extraordinary sums of money in silver dollars from the air, from the pockets, ears, noses, and hats of people in the audience, and threw them all into a large copper pot. The chink of the coins seemed never to stop. Possessed by unappeasable greed, he turned the girl into gold and was horrified by what he had done. He tapped her with a hammer. He chipped off a hand and passed it through the audience. He struck the image in the face. Then, in an ecstasy of renunciation, he broke his magician's wand. Immediately the copper pot was empty, and when we turned our attention to the girl, she was flesh again. But one hand was missing, and blood was running from her lip. This spice of cruelty seemed to please the audience very much. His last illusion was called The Vision of Dr. Faustus, and the program assured us that in this scene, and this alone, the beautiful Faustina would appear before us. Reduced to its fundamentals, it was the familiar illusion in which the magician makes a girl appear in two widely separated cabinets without seeming to pass between them. But as Isengrim did it, the conflict was between sacred and profane love for the soul of Faust. On one side of the stage would appear the beautiful Faustina as Gretchen, working at her spinning wheel and modestly clothed. As Faust approached her, she disappeared, and on the other side of the stage, in an arbor of flowers, appeared Venus, wearing as near to nothing at all as the Mexican sense of modesty would permit. It was plain enough that Gretchen and Venus were the same girl, but she had gifts as an actress and conveyed unmistakably the message that beauty of spirit and lively sensuality might inhabit one body, an idea that was received with delight by the audience. At last, Faust, driven to distraction by the difficulties of choice, killed himself, and Mephistopheles appeared in flames to drag him down to hell. As he vanished, in the middle of the stage, but about 8 feet above the floor, and supported apparently on nothing at all, appeared the beautiful Faustina once more, as, one presumes, the eternal feminine, radiating compassion while showing a satisfactory amount of leg. The culminating moment came when Mephistopheles threw aside his robe and showed that, whoever may have been thrust down into hell, this was certainly Isengrim the Great. The audience took very kindly to the show, and the applause for the finale was long and enthusiastic. An usher prevented me from going through the pass door to the stage, so I went to the stage door and asked to see Señor Isengrim. "He was not to be seen," said the doorman. Orders were strict that no one was to be admitted. I offered a visiting card, for although these things have almost gone out of use in North America, they still possess a certain amount of authority in Europe, and I always carry a few. But it was no use. I was not pleased, and was about to go away in a huff, when a voice said, "Are you Mr. Dunstan Ramsay?" The person who was speaking to me from the last step of the stairs that led up into the theater was probably a woman, but she wore man's dress, had short hair, and was certainly the ugliest human creature I had ever seen. Not that she was misshapen. She was tall, straight, and obviously very strong. But she had big hands and feet, a huge jutting jaw, and a heaviness of bone over the eyes that seemed to confine them to small, very deep caverns. However, her voice was beautiful, and her utterance was an educated speech of some foreign flavor. "Isengrim will be very pleased to see you. He noticed you in the audience. Follow me, if you please." The backstage arrangements were not extensive, and the corridor into which she led me was noisy with the sound of a quarrel in a language unfamiliar to me, probably Portuguese. My guide knocked and entered at once with me behind her, and we were upon the quarrelers. They were Isengrim, stripped to the waist, rubbing paint off his face with a dirty towel, and the beautiful Faustina, who was naked as the dawn, and lovely as the breeze, and madder than a wet hen. She also was removing her stage paint, which seemed to cover most of her body. She snatched up a wrapper and pulled it around her, and extruded whatever part she happened to be cleaning as we talked. "She says she must have more pink light in the last tableau," said Isengrim to my guide in German. "I've told her it will kill my red Mephisto spot, but you know how pig-headed she is." "Not now," said the ugly woman. "Mr. Dunstan Ramsay, your old friend Magnus Isengrim, and the beautiful Faustina." The beautiful Faustina gave me an unnervingly brilliant smile, and extended a very greasy hand that had just been wiping paint off her upper thigh. I may be a Canadian of Scots descent, and I may have first seen the light in Deptford, but I am not to be disconcerted by Latin American showgirls, so I kissed it with what I think was a good deal of elegance. Then I shook hands with Isengrim, who was smiling in a fashion that was not really friendly. "It has been a long time, Mr. Dunstable Ramsay," he said in Spanish. I think he meant to put me at a disadvantage, but I'm pretty handy in Spanish, and we continued the conversation in that language. "It has been over 30 years, unless you count our meeting in Le Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite," said I. "How are Le Solitaire des Forêts and my friend the Bearded Lady?"
"Le Solitaire died very shortly after we met," said he. "I have not seen the others since before the war."
We made a little more conversation, so stilted and uneasy that I decided to leave. Obviously, Isengrim did not want me there. But when I took my leave, the ugly woman said,
"We hope very much that you can lunch with us tomorrow."
"Liesel, are you sure you know what you are doing?" said Isengrim in German, and very rapidly. But I am pretty handy in German, too. So when the ugly woman replied,
"Yes, I am perfectly sure, and so are you, so say no more about it,"
I got it all, and said in German, "It would be a very great pleasure if I am not an intruder."
"How can a so old friend possibly be an intruder?" said Isengrim in English, and thenceforth he never spoke any other language to me, though his idiom was creaky. "You know, Liesel, that Mr. Ramsay was my very first teacher in magic." He was all honey now, and as I was leaving he leaned forward and whispered,
"That temporary loan, you remember? Nothing would have induced me to accept it if Le Solitaire had not been in very great need. You must permit me to repay it at once."
And he tapped me lightly on the spot where, in an inside pocket, I carry my cash. That night, when I was making my usual prudent Canadian Scots count, I found that several bills had found their way into my wallet, slightly but not embarrassingly exceeding the sum that had disappeared from it when last I met Paul. I began to think better of Isengrim. I appreciate scrupulosity in money matters. 3. Thus I became a member of Magnus Isengrim's entourage, and never made my tour of the shrines of South America. It was all settled at the luncheon after our first meeting. Isengrim was there, and the hideous Liesel, but the beautiful Faustina did not come. When I asked after her, Isengrim said,
"She is not yet ready to be seen in public places."
Well, thought I, if he can appear in a good restaurant with a monster, why not with the most beautiful woman I have ever seen? Before we had finished a long luncheon, I knew why. Liesel became less ugly after an hour or two. Her clothes were like a man's in that she wore a jacket and trousers, but her shirt was soft and her beautiful scarf was drawn through a ring. If I had been in her place, I should not have worn men's patent leather dancing shoes, size 11 at least, but otherwise she was discreet. Her short hair was smartly arranged, and she even wore a little color on her lips. Nothing could mitigate the extreme, the deformed ugliness of her face, but she was graceful, she had a charming voice, and gave evidence of a keen intelligence held in check, so that Isengrim might dominate the conversation. "You see what we are doing," he said. "We are building up a magic show of unique quality, and we want it to be in the best possible condition before we set out on a world tour. It is rough still." "Oh, very kind of you to say so, but it is rough in comparison with what we want to make it. We want the uttermost accomplishment, combined with the sort of charm and romantic flourish that usually goes with ballet, European ballet, not the athletic American stuff. You know that nowadays the theater has almost abandoned charm. Actors want to be sweaty and real. Playwrights want to scratch their scabs in public. Very well, it is in the mood of the times. But there is always another mood, one precisely contrary to what seems to be the fashion. Nowadays this concealed longing is for romance and marvels. Well, that is what we think we can offer, but it is not done with the back bent and a cringing smile. It must be offered with authority. We are working very hard for authority. You remarked that we did not smile much in the performance. No jokes, really. A smile in such a show is half a cringe. Look at the magicians who appear in nightclubs. They are so anxious to be loved, to have everybody think, 'What a funny fellow,' instead of, 'What a brilliant fellow, what a mysterious fellow.' That is the disease of all entertainment. Love me,
pet me, pat my head. That is not what we want.
What do you want? To be feared?
To be wondered at. This is not egotism. People want to marvel at something, and the whole spirit of our time is not to let them do it.
They will pay to do it, if you make it good and marvelous for them.
Didn't anybody learn anything from the war? Hitler said, "Marvel at me, wonder at me. I can do what others can't," and they fell over themselves to do it. What we offer is innocent, just an entertainment in which a hungry part of the spirit is fed. But it won't work if we let ourselves be pawed and patronized and petted by the people who have marveled. Hence our plan.
What is your plan?
That the show must keep its character all the time. I must not be seen off the stage except under circumstances that carry some cachet. I must never do tricks outside the theater. When people meet me, I must be always the distinguished gentleman conferring a distinction, not a nice fellow just like the rest of the boys. The girls must have it in their contract that they do not accept invitations unless we approve, appear anywhere except in clothes we approve, get into any messes with boyfriends, or seem to be anything but ladies. Not easy, you see. Faustina herself is a problem. She has not yet learned about clothes, and she eats like a lioness.
You'll have to pay heavily to make people live like that.
Of course. So the company must be pretty small, and the pay tempting. We shall find the people.
Excuse me, but you keep saying, we will do this, and we will do that. Is this a royal we? If so, you may be getting into psychological trouble.
No, no. When I speak of we, I mean Liesel and myself. I am the magician. She is the autocrat of the company, as you shall discover.
And why is Liesel the autocrat of the company?
That also you shall discover.
I'm not at all sure of that. What do you want me for? My abilities as a magician are even less than when you were my audience in the Deptford Free Library.